Session number 23349, Mr. Keith Nutter, reels 9 and 10, possibly 11. Left channel informants, mic only, right channel interviewers, mic.
Keith Nutter, reel 9. We were talking about the preparations and, well, a briefing for the patrol that Lieutenant Towell and Lieutenant Wormald took out on the 29th of May 1952. You said that one of the things they did was the code words for the support.
Well, this is it. We had all the support arms, and we were conversant then with what they could do as regards the tanks, you know, and machine guns, and the artillery. But they all had their own individual code names. I mean, these code words would I really can't. Most likely phonetic alphabet. With a prefix of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 behind the phonetic alphabet call sign, we had to be conversant with them because the 31 set operator with the patrol was sole communication with the support arm. So
now,
if we want,
now tell me a bit about the move on to the wireless arrangements. What was the wireless? I know some of this is duplicate, but if you could give us it clearly,
that's
what it was.
Fine. Yeah, well, the wireless arrangements were such as this: a 31 set upper. Anybody, a 31 set upper in a situation like this, would be the control. By the control, I mean he'd be in charge of the net. The net is all his substations. Now, they do as he tells them. In other words, if he asks for radio silence, they obey, and it's radio silence. He's in control of that net. That enables him to call in whatever he wants to call in, whether it's support to evacuate wounded, whether it's artillery fire, tank fire, machine gun fire. He gives the order then, through his platoon commander, who by the way, is leading the platoon, so he can't really, he just says, call in the artillery, call in the tanks, you know, and he knows very well that signal that then knows what he means by that and where this fire is going to, because all these things are predetermined before the event. I mean, they're most likely zeroed in in this case, on Tombstone. The tank, the Centurions would be zeroed in with shells on Tombstone, so they knew just where to drop them. And the same with the artillery. They'd be dropping theirs, no doubt, over the back of Tombstone to stop any Chinese reinforcement coming up that way. And so the signaller then had to be very conversant with all these, because the patrol depended on him knowing just what were going on over the airways.
Now, not only would it be linking with other 31 sets, but also you'd have some 88 sets with the...
Yes, it would be linking. I gather the tanks would be got 31 sets, and the artillery and all of those had be got a set that were compatible to the 31 set. And I suppose the only other set would be another 31 set. The only thing that were compatible with it was the 88 sets, which the sections and any forward elements had, so that they were then, because they were compatible with the 31 set as regards wave bands. The 88 set is a small pack that's carried on the belt with the headphones and a free dangling microphone, and that enables the sections up front or whoever's got one up front to speak then to the controller on his 31 set, and then he can then inform the platoon commander, whatever the patrol commander, what's going on, and they can communicate that way from forward sections back to the main 31 set with the main patrol, then back to firm base, who most likely did have another 88 set on firm base, and then back to battalion company headquarters and battalion headquarters. That's how the setup were really with a signaller.
Now, what was the plan for all these for the unit? You had, you know, for the firm bases and then for the advanced, because it wasn't just one platoon.
No,
it was also the assault.
The assault pioneers come in with us. This is it. I assumed that they assumed the battalion that the Chinaman was occupying Tombstone, definitely in the hours of darkness. This patrol, then, I think the object of this patrol was to go and knock them off that hill, upset them with the fighting patrol, in other words, put it bluntly, I suppose, kill as many Chinamen as we could, you know. The patrol was under Tony Towell, with the forward element with Lieutenant Wormald. We went out at last light. Before we went out in the afternoon, if you're on patrol, you wear the afternoon off. You know these things, you're going on patrol, so you make certain you've got a good battery in your radio, you got your magazines loaded up, and you went down the bottom of the hill if you wanted to, and you could give a food burst at an old tin can anywhere down the bottom of the hill and on the reverse slopes, just so you know how your weapon were working okay, which happened, and we did. The patrol would go off about last light or just after. You know, in other words, in the twilight or in the darkness.
Now, tell me exactly what you were carrying and what weapons you had and just generally what you go out in.
Well, I would go out in, I suppose it one of the old jungle hats, the old floppy hats at that time, I suppose we were wearing. Or it might have been a cap comfort, I'm not quite sure. I'll be carrying a 31 set.
A 31 set is
a backpack set, which is about 2 foot wide, I suppose, and about 2 foot six in length. It weighs 30, it's a 31 set, it weighs 30 and a quarter pound. The battery weighs 10 pound. It has a range of 3 miles on the whiplash aerial and 3 miles plus on the long aerial, which is always carried but very rarely used. There's 41 channels on a 31 set. I inadvertently said it ain't got many channels, but since then, on reflection, it's got 41 channels. So it gives us a fair old range of channels. I'll be carrying that, and then I would be carrying my personal weapon, which would be a Sten gun with two loaded magazines actually in the Sten, one engaged in the aperture of the barrel, and the other tape with adhesive tape on the end, so for quick swing around if needed. And I'll also, I think, be carrying 2 4 magazines in me pouch and most likely 2 .36 grenades in the other pouch. As well as that, I'd be having the bayonet on the side of my ammunition pouch. I can't think of anything else on the patrol. There'd be no small pack. It would be, you know, because I'd got the radio and I don't think the ordinary rifleman carried a small pack on that sort of patrol. Just ammunition pouches.
Now, would you darken your face at all or anything like that?
I suppose we did. I can't really remember doing that, but I can't see why we didn't. We always done it in training. And any pictures I see of the era with the Norfolk Sidon Patrol, we've all got blackened faces. So I suppose we did. I just can't honestly remember doing that, but if everybody else had done it, I did, no doubt.
Now, so tell me how you went out. You went out when?
Well, we went out at last light. Now, I should think the first job I would done, once I made contact with Tony Tower, while we were still in company positions, first thing I would done would establish the net. Establishing the net means I know who's in the net. They may be five substations, artillery, MG platoon, 5th Dragoon Guards, going round. And I established the net by calling each station up in turn. And the station, for sake of argument, we'll call it Abel Baker Charlie, which was the phonetic alphabet in them days. I'd say Abel Baker Charlie 1, report my signals. Abel Baker Charlie 1 would report back. I don't know whether they said strength 5 or whether that was American way of doing it. Abel Baker Charlie 1, okay, over, or something like that. So I know Abel Baker Charlie 1, I'll go around the net, and then there'd be Abel Baker Charlie 2 would be the artillery, Abel Baker Charlie 3 the Dragoon Guards, all around the net like that. And also the 88 cent operator would have his own call sign, that'd be Abel Baker Charlie 1 perhaps, you see, the one who'd be forward of me. So we established the net, and then when Tony Sale said right, Tony Tower would say right, we're ready to move off, I would then give it the appropriate code name to the forward section, whatever that would be, and they'd know that meant we're moving off. And the appropriate code name would have been heard by all the substations, so they'd know, right, patrol's on the way. So then we'd...
Would that mean wireless silence from then on?
From then, I was just going to say then, that that's a good point, because before then, they knew once this net was established, they'd been told then it's wireless silence. So nobody the pressed a pressure switch or sent a message at all. Unless it was the forward section and they were in trouble. So then we would start off then with wireless silence.
Now how many were on the patrol? And there was
In Mr. Wormhole's patrol, I should think there were about 20. I don't know. I don't really know because they were a platoon that only comparatively recently joined the company as a platoon, and I didn't really know the strength of that. In Tony Tower's section, which was following Mr. Wormhold's
platoon, not section. Wouldn't
sorry,
it?
Platoon. Tony Tower's platoon following.
That's 8 platoon.
That was 8 platoon. The platoon strength, I suppose, is very difficult to say. I would suppose about 30 of us. Tony Tower would know this more than me. That there was a certain. It's very difficult to say the numbers. I would think they might be 30, but I could be corrected on this. Numbers didn't mean so much to me. I was just doing the job I was doing, and I left it, you know, to the platoon commander and the patrol commander to sort the numbers out that were in front and behind us.
And there was also Tom Henson was on it as well, wasn't he?
No, Tom wasn't on it that time.
I thought he was the one left behind as the first firm base.
I don't think so. I wouldn't argue on that. If Tom says he were. I couldn't remember Tom being on that one.
You don't remember that part?
No, remember dropping off firm base. We went out.
No, tell me how. So you went out. Tell me what formation you went and how you got out through the wire and the rest of it.
Well, we went out with Mr. Wormhold's platoon leading the way. It was evidently a predetermined track. He knew the way, in other words, through the minefields, etc., and through the wire. That would be followed by Tony Tower's platoon, which consisted of an element to be dropped off on what we call a firm base. This is why I'm a bit confused about numbers that were in the actual. Anyway, so what happened, we follow Mr. Wormhold through the minefields and through the paddy field paths, and we go over a feature called Italy. Now, this feature Italy is called Italy because looking at it on a map, it's just like the shape of Italy. So we go up Italy. Now, as I recall, firm base gets dropped on Italy.
It's firm base one, is it? Well,
yes, firm. We'll call this firm base one. I understood firm base one was under command of a sergeant, but I may be wrong. It may have been Tom, but Tony would know this more than I. But it was definitely a firm base on Italy.
Now, what was a firm base? If you just explain what it was.
Well, I'd never really been on a firm base. I'd always been forward with the patrol if a patrol had gone. So a firm base would be stretcher bearers, as I understand it, and more support, you know, a body of men well armed to come forward and help you get out of a mess. That's the idea of firm base. And so, in other words, wounded could be ferried back to firm base, and firm base then would ferry them back to the battalion. That's what I think the firm base would be. We dropped firm base off on Italy. We went forward.
Now, how far forward was that from the British front line, roughly? I mean, it's
well,
very
I suppose about a mile, I think. I don't know. 3/4 of a mile to a mile, I would say.
And what formation would you be walking in? I mean,
well, we're walking in single file with. I'm not sure, you see, it could be that Mr. Wormhold would lead in it, so Tony Tower could be leading his platoon, in which case, knowing that Mr. Wormhold was in front and basically cleared the ground of any ambush because he was in front, so Tony could have been at the front of his platoon. And if Tony was at the front, I was next to him because Tony had to be near the 31 set because the only communication Tony had was by this microphone was on about a couple of foot of... Or 3 or 4 foot of cable from the 31 set, free hanging microphone, you see. So anyway, we dropped the firm base off, and from there on, Mr. Wormhold's platoon went forward to Tombstone. We followed on. At some point, I would say, I may be wrong, but at some point I would say at the base of Tombstone, we dropped off Tony's platoon, or the body of men with Tony, I don't know the strength, stopped there. Mr. Wormhold then went on, we'll say, to attack Tombstone.
So when you what was the firm base two then? How did you set yourselves up, the platoon of you all, however many were left at there?
Well, we done all round defence. We dropped in a position. Firm base, I'm not sure how they set themselves up because we'd gone by then. We left that to whoever was in charge of firm base. They set themselves up in a defensive position, no doubt listening on the 88 set to see what were going on forward of them. When Tony dropped off and Mr. Wormhold carried on, I think it was somewhere at the base of the Tombstone. We then got ourselves out in the defensive position. It's kind of all-round defence, weapons at the ready. It was still silent. No shells going on in our area. There were shells and flares going on along the front, but nothing in our immediate area.
Now, can you talk a bit more about what it was like for you with this 31 set with the headphones on and the rest of it? Because it's a strange position to be in
because you're going along with radio silence, you got your headsets on, because if your headset had your headset dangling around your neck, the static could come out the headsets and it'd carry the same way it would carry. So you had your earphones on, you're in one hand, you're holding your Sten gun. I suppose in my case that'd be in my right hand, and in my left hand, maybe supporting the magazines of the Sten gun, would be the microphone, which got a pressure switch on it, which you have to press when you speak and you send in a message. And it's very difficult because you've got totally reliant on the people around you. If they freeze, you freeze. So you're relying on them to use their ears to pick up a sound. And if a trip flare goes off, naturally you see that, so you either hit the deck or you freeze where you are if you're in a crouched position. But in other words, you're totally really reliant on all the people around you. And they're, from their point of view, totally reliant on you for communication. So we're all working together. And this is the thing.
Now, so you were at the fort, as you remember it, of Tombstone, when Wormhold, Second Lieutenant Wormhold, and Corporal Guess, a few others.
His body and men. I'm not quite sure how many.
It says nine men, but I mean, besides
well,
those,
it could be. Now that could be.
It's not necessarily right.
This is why I didn't say Mr. Wormhold's platoon, because the platoon would be more than nine men. I thought it was 9 to 12 men actually, so that could be right. But I didn't mention figures because I could be wrong. But that they went on, proceeded up Tombstone.
Now, and you were sat at the bottom.
We were in an all-round defensive position, on the alert, you know, because when you're in a position like that, you know the Chinaman's very near, so you're on edge. You're all, you know, I would have got the earphones on and still looking round and, you know, being prepared for whatever may happen. Well, then, to put it in, how I would say, all hell broke loose on Tombstone. There was Chinese firing going all around, mortars landing round us and shells rocketing. I don't know, they've been ambushed, in other words. We all thought, I think they'd run into a Chinese ambush on Tombstone. So whether the Chinamen had got wise to the fact that we were probing this position and they were ready for it, I don't know. But there was a terrific lot of firing, so we knew they were in a bit of a mess on Tombstone. Now, what happened then is, regards radio communication, the pressure switch on the 88 set up with Mr. Wormhold was pressed, but no speech come through at all. The pressure switch was depressed, no speech. I didn't get a signal. I got a signal from the pressure switch to know that the line was, you know, they were trying, but there were no speech come through. So I didn't get a contact with that operator at all. I tried to raise him, to no avail. We couldn't raise him at all on the radio. So this then transpires. Tony has to decide what to do then, because is the backup section or platoon got to go forward and get out any wounded or what do whatever's got to be done. Let's see. Then he must make these decisions. He knew, I suppose, in his mind, he knew what he'd have to do if Mr. Wormhold got into trouble. He no doubt done it. He then gathers his section of men round him together, however many they were of us, and he says, we're going forward to see what we can do, in other words, to get the wounded out. Then there must be some problems in front with this amount of firing going on.
Now hang on, did he do this before the support arms were brought in or after?
I think this was before the support arms were brought in. I can't recall in any support arms before we moved forward.
So he was giving you this briefing. What did you think when he said you were going forward?
Well, I thought, crikey, surely I ain't got to go forward with this flipping got wireless on me back. But I didn't say that. I honestly, if I'm being told to do a thing in the eye, I always done it. I didn't question an order ever. So if Tony said, I think words to the effect, we've got to go forward, Ginger. I should want you with me, Ginger. Words to that effect, and that was it.
Now, how many were going forward?
Well, this would be the body of men that with Tony. I didn't think it was all that great a body of men. I wouldn't think it was platoon strength. I would think more like strong section strength than platoon strength. But Tony had no more of this than me. Anyway, then we brought support fire down.
Now tell me exactly how you did that.
Well, Tony, then I should imagine we we brought artillery down, going over the back of Tombstone first to keep the Chinese, I gather, from coming up, you know, and reinforcing the Chinese that were on Tombstone. We then brought the 5th DG Centurion tanks to fire onto Tombstone because they got their coordinates all right and they were zeroed in. And we basically went forward under covering fire of, well, I think covering fire of the Centurion, because we could look across and see our company position. We were a mile away, whatever it were, and we could see these Centurions and we could see these shells. I don't know whether every one shows up, but there were occasional trace if every one don't. And you could see these shells coming and landing at the top of Tombstone as we went up the bank, up the side of Tombstone.
Now, had you come under any fire at this time?
Well, I think we perhaps had. I think we had. But I'd got the earphones on and there were bangs and flashes all around us. So I really don't know. I think according to read accounts, we had been under fire.
When you mentioned that perhaps some mortar shells landed near you, you weren't quite sure what was going on, but that was an impression.
It was the impression that the Chinese roughly knew what was going on and that they were peppering those positions.
Now, what happened when you went up the hill? What was it like going up the hill? What was the terrain like?
It weren't rugged. As I remember, it was a very barren slope and it was devoid, as I said, of any vegetation. We took it very steady because we didn't know quite what was going on. We were looking for wounded people or survivors or anything we could find. So we cautiously went up Tombstone. As I understand, we passed walking wounded. Some walking wounded were passed back through us. They were very confused people, as anybody perhaps would be who had just been in an ambush. We ferried them back through us to firm base. Whether Tony sent them back with somebody from our little body to send them back, you know, to ferry them back. I don't know about that, but we definitely sent some back through us. We came across one man. All the time the Centurions were really pounding the top of Tombstone, these Chinese trenches. And we found one man, one wounded were found. I think it was a leg wound, I'm not sure, because Tony said, Tony gave him more. I remember Tony were giving him morphine or sorting him out. I were then continuing to talk to the 5th DGs. I don't think I called for mortar fire because I hadn't got too much confidence in the mortar fire dropping as close as this. But I don't know. I don't think I did. But I think then I got the 5th DGs to lift their fire up a little bit as we went up Tombstone. That's how I think I'd done that. Anyway, I can always remember Tony with this man on the stretcher. He was giving him morphine, I think. And I
Do you know who it was?
No, I don't. No, I never did find out. And I can always remember one thing. We'd come to a halt because Tony was sorting this man out. And I can always remember, I weren't an NCO, but I can always remember, and I got a Royalist on me back. I said, come on, all round defence. We did. We all got down. It may have been somebody else had all said that as well. But I didn't hear it with my earphones. And I said, all round defence. And we just scattered round in a little circle, pointing, you know, weapons pointing all ways. Anyway, Tony got that one away. Somebody ferried him back on the stretcher. Maybe another two blokes depleted from us, you know. And we continued then to... These 50 Gs were doing a marvellous job on this top of this hill. They really were. They weren't many yards in front of us where they were exploding. And we crawled round as we could see the side of Tombstone, basically up to the Chinese trenches almost. I mean, I think if they'd have looked at the Chinese trenches, they'd have seen us. They couldn't have avoided it in the flashing of the shells going off, you know. But these Centurions were doing a marvellous job.
So you all went forward?
We went forward up to...
you and Tony?
Not just me and Tony. Well, I don't know. It weren't me and Tony, I'm sure. I don't know who were with us. We went forward anyway. I mean, I don't think it was me and Tony, no, I'm sure it weren't. I mean, we all went forward as a little body, but I don't think how many of us, actually, by then. And we went forward, well, I suppose as far as we could, up Tombstone, and we searched both sides of this hill, looking for wounded. We still couldn't find a lot of them. We didn't see, some of them had got back without coming through us, some of the walking wounded. It got down Tombstone without coming through us, you see, so we didn't know they were got, you know, what had happened to them. This didn't just transpire in a few minutes. This action was going on for quite a while. I wouldn't like to put a figure on it, how long it went, but it was going on. We were searching on the side of Tombstone for the people unaccounted for. Then
how were you feeling? Were you nervous? And, I mean, you know, I mean.
Well, I don't really think I were. I were frightened going up. I thought, crikey, what we letting ourselves in for? But I can't really recall being frightened while it were happening. I was doing what I was supposed to do, and I were apprehensive, like we all were. What, you know, because you don't know quite who's going to shoot out from where and what out, what's going to hit you and what end. But I wouldn't say I were brave, but I wouldn't say I were frightened to the extent I couldn't do my job. You know, I really, no. I always think, looking back, I always think I'm rather proud that I'd done the job I were trained to do under difficult conditions, and I'd done it well. You know, messages were getting where they got to get, and I was receiving messages where I got to receive them. And I like to think that, you know, people often wonder if, when they ain't been under fire before, okay, we'd had shells before when we were in the company position, but never in an exposed place like that. And you often wonder, you know, what will I do? Well, okay, I didn't do nothing dramatic, but I done what I were there to do, and I thought, okay, that was it. So I was pleased with that anyway. I didn't crumple, in other words, you know.
And now, what had happened to the wireless operator, the 88 operator with APP? Now, he'd pressed his button, but nothing had happened.
To this day, I don't know what happened to him. Whether he was one of the wounded we picked up or passed through us, I don't think it was Bob Guest. I think he'd have told me. I've met Bob since the occasion. You know, I don't think a Lance Corporal had ever wireless on. I don't know, but Bob never mentioned this, so I don't know really what happened to that chap. But anyway, the search went on,
and all the time covered by the 5th Dragoon
all
Guards.
The time covered by the 5th Dragoon Guards and the artillery going on all these surrounding Chinese hills. I don't think at that time we called the machine guns in. Only saying that when after the event, a few years after the event, I was talking to somebody who ran the Vickers, the old Vickers. Which
would that be John Denny?
No, I was talking to one of his operators, actually, after the event. I can't think of his name. Bloke who lives in Norfolk. Brother-in-law of Signal Sergeant Chambers. So that's how I met him. And he said, on that night, we fired 26,000 rounds from the Vickers. So they were firing somewhere, whether it was when we were on Tombstone or whether it was the following morning when we were getting back, I don't know, but he said we fired 26,000 rounds, you know, like from the Vickers. Whether that was his own gun or two Vickers, I don't really know, but they were firing anyway. But I just couldn't remember calling them, and it was the DGs that were really doing as a fantastic lot of covering fire.
And were the 25 pounders still firing at the back of
them? I think so, because they weren't landing amongst us anyway, so we didn't particularly want them to.
Not the mortars, you didn't have.
I can't remember calling the mortars in. I'd had a thing about the mortars, and I can't remember. And it could be that Tony told me to call the support arms in which case I may have left the mortars out, because I thought, well, how are they going to know? We were so near the Chinese position. I thought, well, are they going to know friend from foe if they start dropping the mortars, you know?
Now, you didn't see the Chinese yourself?
No, I never seen a Chinaman, no.
Could you see their trenches, though?
Well, we could see their trenches, their earthworks at the top of Tombstone. Yes, we could.
And how far off were you?
Well, I don't think we were many yards, really. You know, 10 yards, perhaps. I think we got within almost, if we'd have won, this lob of grenade into that trench. But if we had it, then they'd have knew we were there. You know, so they'd pop their heads up and we'd have been at it. No, I honestly don't think they realised we were as close
as
that.
But you saw no sign of either Wormhold or Guest?
No,
we saw no
sign of any, of apart from the wounded which we picked up and passed through us, we saw no sign of any, what we thought then were the missing men.
So how long were you doing this for? I know you don't know time, but...
Well, we must have been doing it for quite a while, because it were must have been getting towards first light, because... Tony Tower, we come back as it were getting, we'd searched pointlessly on this hill and found what we could and knew we have nothing left to find. So Tony Tower then, I gather, pulls us back down from the top of Tombstone, we'll say, from the forward slopes, from these slopes of Tombstone near the Chinese trenches. I think when we get to the base of Tombstone, he then...
So you went back to Firm Base 2?
We'll call it Firm Base 2, yeah. This is my remembrance. Tony then gets on the radio and he gets permission from the... Well, I think it's perhaps the company commander, but it may have been the CO. He gets permission from one of the commanding officer or the battalion commander to stay behind in daylight and see if we can see any wounded laying around. Permission was granted. So
now who stayed?
As I remember, it was Tony Towler, myself, and a brain gun team, and I can't remember anymore. I think one of the brain gun was Joe Brooks, who I think you have interviewed actually some time ago. But anyway, I'm pretty sure it was Joe Brooks. Since I didn't know at the time, and since it transpired, I think it was Joe Brooks. But anyway, as I remember it, we.